Nomoto presents American presidents. John Hanson, often mythologized as first president under the Articles, 1781 to 1782. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 12 minutes. The story most people hear about John Hanson arrives as a neat provocation. Before George Washington, there was another first president, a dignified Marylander who held the office under the Articles of Confederation and whose name we somehow forgot. The claim survives because it flatters the appetite for secret histories and because Hanson, when you look closely, does sit at a hinge in time, with a gavel but without an army, receiving dispatches from generals and ministers while presiding over a government that called itself the United States in Congress assembled. The myth confuses titles with power, but it points at something real, a single sober year in which an untheatrical planter merchant from Charles County occupied the chair at the center of a fragile union and, by working it like a desk and not a throne, helped the Republic stagger from victory toward peace without coming apart. He came from tobacco country, not from salons or academies. Born in 1715, Hanson grew up in Maryland's older tidewater politics, parish vestries, county courts, committees that ran on neighborly obligation and a hard memory for who had done what. He learned bookkeeping and bargaining, served as sheriff and burgess, and became the kind of local figure people called when they wanted something done and written down. Long before he set foot in Philadelphia, he had earned a reputation in Annapolis as a man who could count votes and calm tempers. During a long dispute over who should control the vast western lands beyond the Appalachians, he became one of Maryland's steady voices arguing that no single state should keep an empire in its pocket. Those lands, he said, should be ceded to the common benefit. Otherwise, the Union would be a polite word for resentment. That argument, pushed year after year with more persistence than fireworks, helped bring his own state to the point of ratifying the Articles in 1781, the final assent that made the Confederation legal. When Thomas McKean resigned the presidency of Congress in early November 1781, the timing was strangely theatrical. Yorktown had fallen just weeks before. The war still rumbled, but the decisive reversal had come. The body needed a chair who would not mistake that triumph for an excuse to drift. On November 5th, the delegates chose Hanson. The title he received, President of the United States in Congress Assembled, sounds, to a modern ear, like the whole of government. In truth, it was the chairmanship of a legislature that tried to act as an executive when it had to and as a diplomatic chancery when it dared. He could recognize speakers, rule on motions, sign commissions and letters, receive envoys, and execute what Congress resolved. He could not appoint generals without Congress, could not spend money that had not been requisitioned from unwilling states, could not make a single tax bite without every legislature's consent. The gap between the grandeur of the title and the narrowness of the tools is the key to understanding his year, and to puncturing the easy myth that he wore a president's crown before Washington did. Hanson treated the office as a discipline. The army, victorious at Yorktown, was still hungry, unpaid, and restless. Washington's dispatches, respectful but edged with urgency, crossed his desk in a stream. Requests for supplies, warnings about morale, reminders that winter did not negotiate. Hanson read them aloud, oversaw referrals to the appropriate committees, and shepherded the resulting resolutions back into the world translated into orders. What he added was tempo. Under a system that could not command obedience, promptness became a kind of substitute power. He answered foreign ministers quickly, acknowledged reports, signed passes, and helped make the Republican habit of meeting its paper obligations look, from the outside, like reliability rather than hope. The alliance with France, which had delivered fleets and credit when the country most needed both, required exactly that steadiness. Etiquette is one form of politics. In 1781 to 82, it was a form of survival. Hanson presided over the reception of the French minister and over the committee reports that smoothed frictions between French officers, American quartermasters, and local authorities. He did not dazzle in French. He did not need to. What the alliance required from the presiding officer of Congress was an unfailing correctness, the right titles on envelopes, the right precedence at dinners, the right quickness in transmitting thanks and explanations. He made sure the gratitude of the United States arrived in time to be believed. At home, the government's finances were a bruise that did not fade. Robert Morris, the superintendent of finance, was trying to drag the Confederation's accounts into coherence, introducing double-entry bookkeeping, cutting waste, pressing an impost on imports that might finally give the center a trickle of its own revenue. Hansen became the reliable hand that pushed Morris's measures through the day's docket. He signed the congressional authorization of the Bank of North America in late 1781, a cornerstone of Morris's plan to rebuild public credit. The bank did not mint prosperity, but it gave the new country a place to balance its ledger, discount its bills, and pretend, just enough, that tomorrow could be paid for when it arrived. In a union that lived on requisitions and faith, that was more than a symbol. If his year has a single emblem, it is a seal. In June 1782, Congress finally adopted the Great Seal of the United States after three committees and years of back and forth. The design, eagle and shield, stars and stripes, olive branch and arrows, was a collage of compromises turned into a single image. Hansen presided over the session and the orders that followed, instructing the secretary to have the seal made and used to authenticate treaties and commissions, went out over his signature. No one would claim that he designed it. Other minds drew the heraldry together. But it mattered that a man like Hansen, the sort of official who cared about how things looked because he cared about what they meant, was there to make the decision operational. Nations become real through habits. The seal was a habit cast in metal. He also oversaw the routine miracles that keep a republic from dissolving into correspondence without consequence. Congress standardized practices for passports and safe conducts, fussed over postal routes and the appointment of a new postmaster. The office's title then was superintendent of the post, and argued about how to apportion the costs of war to states that preferred to think they had paid enough. Hansen's chair was the place where these quarrels were cooled into minutes and sent back out as policy. He could not make Pennsylvania love an impost or Rhode Island hurry a vote, but he could ensure that the asking was done exactly and often. Under the articles, persuasion had to be written, he wrote. The legend that later ballooned around his name, first president of the United States, grew in the soil of this year, watered by the understandable urge to find an origin story. It is true that he was the first to complete a full one-year term as president of Congress after the articles took effect. McKean had served only a few months. It is true that he signed commissions and proclamations with a title that included the phrase President of the United States. It is also true that the men who watched him work did not for a moment think they had chosen a national executive on the model of a king. The presidency Hansen filled was a moderator's, and he filled it with the self-erasing diligence of a moderator who wants the institution to outlast any man. The myth slights him by pretending he was something he was not. His value lay in being precisely what he was. He had, like most of his generation, limits that read now as sharp shadows. The language of liberty, so fluent in Congress, did not run into the lives of all. Maryland's political class, Hansen among them, lived within a plantation economy built on enslaved labor. He did not conduct a public reckoning with that contradiction, and nothing in his year in the chair suggests he tried. He worked instead on the problems he believed lay within his reach: order, paper, credit, coordination. The revolution had room for prophets and pamphleteers. It also depended on men who treated the day's business as moral work. Hansen was of the second kind. By the end of his term, the war's center of gravity had moved from battlefields to negotiating tables. Peace commissioners in Paris were inching toward preliminary articles. British garrisons sat uneasy in New York and Charleston. The army waited for money that did not arrive. Hansen stepped down in November 1782 as custom dictated after a year, and the chair passed on. The letters he had signed kept traveling, to governors who would not answer quickly enough, to generals who had learned to ration hope, to bankers who wanted collateral that did not exist. He had been, for 12 months, the person who made sure those letters had dates and seals and a path. In a system that was more promise than power, that role was not small. He did not live long enough to see the Treaty of Peace fully ratified or the new national government born under the Constitution that would repair so many of the Articles' defects. He died the following year, in 1783, worn by age and the satisfactions and sorrows of a public life mostly spent in rooms where the work is all patience. Maryland would later send his statue to the Capitol's Statuary Hall, and a 20th-century appetite for clever contrarian facts would inflate his presidency into a hidden crown. The truth, plainer and better, is that for one exacting year, he kept the center's paperwork honest in a government that had very little else to study it. What finally did he do? He dignified a weak office by refusing to pretend it was strong. He lent his signature to measures that mattered. The bank, the seal, the 1,000 small authorizations without which troops are not fed and ministers are not believed. He pushed, by punctuality and regularity, against the centrifugal habits of 13 jealous states. He made Congress look, from the distance of Versailles and London, like something that could be dealt with. What did he fail to do? He could not give Congress income or obedience. He could not pay the army or silence the creditors. He could not answer the great American contradiction at the heart of his own society. The value of his year is that he did not confuse those limits with license to do nothing. He did the work. He cleared the desk. He left the chair ready for the next man. And in the long genealogy of the American presidency, that quiet competence is not the least of the ancestors.